The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, concluded.
Cassette 11, Side 2.
A girl who was her gymnasium friend made a drawing of her which consisted solely of circles. Her head was round from all angles. She had a round forehead and round eyes, which somehow expressed eternal perplexity. The lobes of her ears rounded off as they grew into her cheeks, and her shoulders were round, and her figure was a sphere. Anna began to think about things too soon in life. As early as the third grade, she asked her teacher's permission to take Dobrolyubov and Dostoevsky from the gymnasium library. The teacher was indignant. "It's too soon for you." "All right, if you don't let me read them here, I'll get them in the city library."
At the age of 13, she emancipated herself from God and ceased to be a believer. At the age of 15, she pored over the church fathers, exclusively for the purpose of furiously refuting the priest in class, to the general satisfaction of her fellow students. However, she herself adopted the steadfastness of the Russian church schismatics as her highest model. She learned, it is better to die than to permit one's spiritual core to be broken. No one interfered with her receiving the gold medal she deservedly won. But what if a schoolgirl challenged the basis of Marxism that way today? In 1917, what a time for study, she went to Moscow and entered Shaplygin's Advanced School for Women in the Department of Philosophy and Psychology. As a gold medalist, she was paid, till the October coup, a State Duma scholarship. This department prepared teachers of logic and psychology for the gymnasiums. Throughout 1918, earning money by giving lessons, she studied psychoanalysis. She apparently remained an atheist, but she felt with her whole soul how, immovably on the fiery roses, the living altar of creation smokes. She managed to pay her due to the poetical philosophy of Giordano Bruno and of Tyutchev, and even at one time considered herself an Eastern Catholic. She changed faiths greedily, perhaps more often than her dresses. There were no dresses, and she did not pay all that much attention to them anyway. And in addition, at the beginning, she considered herself a socialist, and that the blood of revolt and civil war was inevitable. But she could not reconcile herself to terror, democracy, but not atrocities. Let hands be steeped in blood, but not in mud. At the end of 1918, she had to leave the school. And did the school exist any longer anyway? With great difficulty, she managed to make her way to her parents, where the food situation was better. She arrived in Mykop. An institute of people's education for adults and for young people had already been created there. Anna became no more and no less than an acting professor of logic, philosophy, and psychology. She was popular with the students. During this period, the whites were living out their last days in Mykop. A 45-year-old general tried to persuade her to flee with him. "General, call off the show. Escape before you are arrested." In those days, at a party for teachers among themselves, the gymnasium history teacher proposed a toast. "To the Great Red Army." Anna rejected the toast. "Not for anything." Knowing her leftist views, her friend's eyes popped out. "Because, notwithstanding the eternal stars, there will be more and more executions," she prophesied. She had the feeling that all the best people were perishing in this war, and only the opportunists were surviving. She already had a presentiment that her great moment was approaching, but she still did not know what it would be. Several days later, the Reds entered Mykop, and a little later a meeting of the city intelligentsia was assembled. The chief of the special section of the Fifth Army, Losev, came out on the stage, and in a menacing tone, not far from cursing, began to abuse the rotten intelligentsia. "What? Sitting on the fence, were you? Waiting for me to invite you? Why didn't you come on your own?" Getting wilder and wilder, he pulled his revolver out of its holster and, brandishing it, screamed, "Your whole culture is rotten. We are going to destroy it and build a new one. And if any of you interfere, we will eliminate you." Whoever has read Krylenko's speeches in Part 1, Chapter 8, already knows all about this. And after that, he proposed, "Who wants to speak?" The hall was as silent as the grave. There was not one single bit of applause, and no hand was lifted. The hall was silent because it was frightened, but the fright was not yet rehearsed, and people did not know that it was compulsory for them to applaud. In all probability, Losef did not think that anyone would rise to speak, but Anna stood up.
"I."
"You," said he rudely. "Well, climb up here, climb up." And she walked the length of the hall and mounted the stage. A big woman with a big face, even with rosy cheeks. This 25-year-old woman was of the generous Russian type. She got only an eighth of a pound of bread, but her father had a good garden. Thick auburn braids reached to her knees, but as an active professor she could not go around with them like that and had them twisted on top of her head, giving herself a second head. And she replied resoundingly, "We have heard out your ignorant speech. You summoned us here, but it was not announced that it was to bury the great culture of Russia. We came here expecting to see a culture bearer and found a grave digger. You would have done better simply to curse us out than to say what you did today. And so, are we supposed to understand that you speak in the name of Soviet power?"
"Yes,"
the already taken aback Losef nonetheless affirmed proudly.
"Well, if the Soviet government is going to have such bandits as you as its representatives, it will fall apart."
Anna had finished, and the whole hall applauded ringingly. Being all together, they were not yet afraid. And the evening came to an end on that note. Losef found nothing else to say. People came up to Anna, pressed her hand in the thick of the crowd, and whispered,
"You are done for. They are going to arrest you right away. But thank you, thank you. We are proud of you, but you are done for. What have you done?"
At home, the Czechists were waiting for her. "Comrade teacher, how poorly you live. A desk, two chairs, and a cot. There's nothing to search. We have never arrested someone like you before. And your father is a worker. How is it that being so poor, you could go over to the side of the bourgeoisie?" The Cheka had not yet got itself organized, and they brought Anna to a room in the chancellery of the special branch, where the White Guard colonel, Baron Bilderling, was already under arrest. Anna witnessed his interrogation and his execution, and later on she went and told his widow,
"He died honorably. Be proud."
They took her for questioning to the room where Losef was living and working. When she entered, he was sitting on his stripped bed in his field breeches and an unbuttoned undershirt, scratching his chest. Anna immediately demanded of the guard,
"Take me out of here."
Losef growled, "All right, I'll wash up and put on those kid gloves in which people make the revolution." For 1 week she awaited her death sentence in a state of ecstasy. Skripnikova now recalls this as the brightest week of her life. If these words are to be understood in their precise meaning, we can believe them completely. This is the kind of ecstasy which descends upon the soul as a reward when you have cast aside all hopes for impossible salvation and have steadfastly given yourself over to a great deed. Love of life destroys this ecstasy. She did not yet know that the city intellectuals had delivered a petition asking that she be pardoned. At the end of the 20s, this would not have been of any help, and in the beginning of the 30s, no one would have been willing to sign. Losef began to take a conciliatory line in interrogating her.
"In all the cities I have captured, I have never met anyone as mad as you. The city is in a state of siege, and all power here is in my hands, and you called me a grave digger of Russian culture? Well, all right, we both lost our tempers. Take back bandit and hooligan."
"No, I still think the same about you."
"They keep coming to me from morning to night to ask for you. In the name of the honeymoon of Soviet power, I'm going to have to let you out."
They let her out, not because they considered her speech harmless, but because she was a worker's daughter. They would not have forgiven a doctor's daughter that. In 1920, Losef himself was shot for banditry and violence in the Crimea. That is how Skripnikova began her journey through prisons. In 1922, she was held in the Krasnodar Cheka, confined there for 8 months, for acquaintance with a suspicious individual. There was epidemic typhus and great congestion in that prison. They gave a bread ration amounting to somewhat less than 2 ounces per day, made from additives, too. In her presence, a child died in the arms of the woman sitting next to her. and Anna took an oath never to have a child under such socialism as this, never to let herself be tempted by motherhood. She kept this oath. She lived out her life without a family, and her fate, her unwillingness to compromise, provided her more than once with the chance to return to prison. Then began what was supposed to be a peaceful life. In 1923, Skripnikova went to enter the Institute of Psychology at Moscow State University. In filling out the security questionnaire, she wrote, "Not a Marxist." Out of kindness of heart, her interviewers advised her, "Are you crazy? Who writes answers like that? State that you're a Marxist and think whatever you please."
"But I have no wish to deceive the Soviet government. I have simply never read Marx."
"Well, all the more so in that case."
"No. When I get around to studying Marxism, and if I accept it."
And for the time being, she took a job teaching in a school for defectives. In 1925, the husband of her close friend, an S.R., fled to escape arrest. In order to force him to return, the GPU seizes hostages in the midst of the NEP hostages. His wife and her friend, that is, Anna. She was just exactly the same round-faced, big-built woman with tresses that reached down to her knees when she entered her cell in Lubyanka. This is where the interrogator assured her, "All those flourishes of the Russian intelligentsia are out of date. Just look after yourself." This time she was imprisoned about a month. In 1927, for participating in a musical society of teachers and workers doomed to be destroyed as a possible nest of free thinking, Anna was arrested for what was by then the fourth time. She got 5 years and served them out on Solovki and the Belomor Canal. From 1932 on, they did not touch her again for a long time. Yes, and evidently she lived more carefully. Beginning with 1948, however, they began to fire her from her jobs. In 1952, the Institute of Psychology returned to her already accepted dissertation, The Psychological Conception of Dobrolyubov, on the grounds of her having received in 1927 a sentence based on Article 58. In this difficult time, she was already in her fourth year of unemployment, a hand reached out to help her from state security. Lisov, a representative of the central state security apparatus. Well, now, here is Losev again. Was he alive? How little had changed, even in the letters, just that he did not stick up his head openly like an elk, Los, but sniffed and darted like a fox, Lisa, who had arrived in Vladikavkaz, proposed that she collaborate, in return for which work would be arranged for her and she would be allowed to defend her dissertation. Proudly, she turned him down. Then they nimbly cooked up a charge that 11 years earlier, in 1941, she had said that we had been poorly prepared for the war. And had we been well prepared? That the German armies were deployed along our borders and that we were sending them grain. And were we not? And on this occasion she got 10 years and landed in the special camps, first Dubrovlag in Mordvinia, then Kamishlag at Suslovo Station in Kemerovo Province. Sensing that impenetrable wall in front of her, she thought up the idea of writing petitions not just anywhere, but to the United Nations. During Stalin's lifetime, she sent off 3 of them. This was not just some sort of trick, not at all. She actually genuinely eased her eternally bubbling soul by speaking in her mind's eye with the UN. She actually, during these decades of cannibalism, had seen no other light in the world. In these petitions, she lashed out at the savage tyranny in the Soviet Union and asked the UN to intervene with the Soviet government and requested either to reinvestigate her case or else to have her executed, since she could no longer go on living under this terror. She would address the envelopes personally to one or another of the Soviet leaders, and inside lay the request that it be sent on to the UN. In Dubrovlag, she was summoned by a clique of the infuriated bosses. "How dare you write to the UN?" Skripnikova stood there, as always, erect, large, majestic.
"Neither in the criminal code, nor in the code of criminal procedure, nor in the Constitution itself is it forbidden, and you ought not to have opened envelopes addressed personally to members of the government."
In 1956, an unloading commission of the Supreme Soviet was functioning in their camp. The only task of this commission was to free as many Zeks as possible, as quickly as possible. There was a certain modest procedure, which consisted in having the Zek say several apologetic words, and stand there a bit with drooping head. But no, Anna Skripnikova was not that kind. Her own personal release was nothing in comparison with common justice. How could she accept forgiveness if she was innocent? And she declared to the commission, "Don't be so overjoyed. All accessories to Stalin's terror are going to have to answer to the people sooner or later. I do not know whom you were personally under Stalin, citizen colonel, but if you were an accessory to his terror, then you too are going to be sitting on the defendant's bench." The members of the commission gulped in fury, shouted that she was insulting the Supreme Soviet in their persons, that this would cost her plenty, and that she would just go on serving time from one toll of the gong to the next. And in actual fact, because of her vain faith in justice, she had to serve 3 extra years. From Kamishlag, she sometimes continued to write to the UN. In 7 years up to 1959, she wrote a total of 80 petitions to various institutions. In 1958, because of these letters, she was sent for 1 year to the Vladimir political prison, and there they had a rule. Once in every 10 days, they would accept a petition directed to any authority. During a half year, she sent 18 declarations from there to different institutions, including 12 to the UN. And she got her way in the end. She got, not execution, but a re-examination of her case, the cases of 1927 and of 1952. She said to the interrogator, "Well, what do you want? A petition to the UN is the only means of knocking a hole in the wall of Soviet bureaucracy and compelling the deaf Themis at least to hear something." The interrogator jumped up and beat his breast. "All the accessories to the Stalinist terror, as you for some reason call the personality cult, will answer to the people. And what am I to answer for? What other policy could I execute at that time? Yes, I believed Stalin without any doubts, and I did not know anything." But Skripnikova kept hitting away at him. "No, no, you can't get away with that. One has to bear the responsibility for every crime. Who is supposed to answer for the deaths of millions of innocents, for the flower of the nation and the flower of the party, the dead Stalin, the executed Beria, while you pursue your political career?" Her own blood pressure at this point was rising to the danger point. She shut her eyes and everything whirled and flamed. And they would still have detained her, but in 1959 a case of this sort was a real curiosity. And in the years that followed, and she is alive right now, her life has been filled with solicitations on behalf of those still imprisoned or in exile, and those whose sentences still remain on the records. Those whom she met in camps in recent years. She got several of them released. She got others rehabilitated. She has also undertaken the defense of those who live in her own city. The city authorities are afraid of her pen and the envelopes she sends off to Moscow, and in some degree they make concessions to her. And if everyone were even one quarter as implacable as Anna Skripnikova, the history of Russia would be different. 2. Stepan Vasilievich Loschilin. He was born in 1908 in the Volga region, the son of a worker at the paper factory. In 1921, during the famine, he was orphaned. He grew up to be a lad who was not very bold, and nevertheless, at the age of 17, he was already a member of the Komsomol, and at the age of 18, he entered a school for peasant youth, and completed it at the age of 21. At this time, they were sent out to help in compulsory exactions of bread grains, and in 1930, in his own native village, he participated in the liquidation of the kulaks. He did not remain behind, however, to build a collective farm there, but got a reference from the village Soviet, and with it went off to Moscow. He had difficulty in finding a job as a manual laborer at a construction project. This was a period of unemployment, and people were swarming into Moscow, especially at this time. A year later, he was called up into the army, and there he was accepted as a candidate member, and later as a full member of the party. At the end of 1932, he was demobilized and returned to Moscow. However, he did not wish to be a manual laborer, and he wanted to acquire skill. So he asked the district committee of the party to assign him as an apprentice at a factory. But evidently he was a pretty incompetent sort of communist, because they turned down even this request, and instead offered him an assignment to the police. And at this point, he refused. Had he taken a different turn, this biography wouldn't have been written. But this, he refused. As a young fellow, he was ashamed to admit to the girls that he was only a manual labourer, that he had no profession. But there was no way he could get that profession. And he went to work at the Kaliber factory once more as a manual labourer. At a party meeting there, he naively spoke out in defence of a worker whom the party bureau had evidently marked down ahead of time for purging. They purged that particular worker just as they had planned, and they began to move in on Loschilin. The party dues he had collected from others were stolen from his barracks, and he was unable to make up the missing 93 rubles out of his own wages. At that point, they expelled him from the party and threatened to prosecute him. Does the loss of party dues really come under the terms of the criminal code? Already in a state of depression, Loschilin did not appear at work one day. He was fired for absenteeism. With a reference like that, he could not get work anywhere for a long, long time. An interrogator kept after him for a while and then left him alone. He kept expecting a trial, but there was none. And suddenly, a verdict in absentia was handed down against him. 6 months of forced labor with a fine of 25% of his pay, to be served through the Municipal Bureau of Corrective Labor, the BITR. In September 1937, Loschilin went to the buffet at the Kiev station. What do we know of our lives? What if he had just gone hungry for another 15 minutes and gone to a buffet in a different place? Perhaps he had some sort of lost or seeking expression on his face. He himself does not know. A young woman in the uniform of the NKVD came toward him. Is that the kind of thing you ought to be doing, woman? She asked him, "What are you looking for? Where are you going?" "To the buffet." She pointed to a door. "Go on, in there." Loschilin, of course, obeyed her. She should have spoken like that to an Englishman. This was the office of the special branch. An official sat behind the desk. The woman said, "Detained during tour of the station." And she went out, and never in his life did Loschilin see her again. And we, too, will never learn anything about her. The official, without offering him a seat, began to question him. He took all his documents away from him and sent him to a room for detained persons. There were two men there already, and as Loschilin himself relates, "This time, without permission, I sat down next to them on an unoccupied chair." All three kept silent for a long time. Policemen came and led them off to cells for preliminary detention. A policeman ordered them to turn over their money to him because, allegedly in the cell, it would be taken from them anyway. What a remarkable identity there is between the police and the thieves. Loschilin lied, saying that he had no money. They began to search him, and they took away his money once and for all, and gave him back his makhorka. With two packets of makhorka, he entered his first cell and put the makhorka on the table. No one else, of course, had anything to smoke. They took him just once from the cell for preliminary detention to the interrogator, who asked him whether he was a thief. And what a rescue that would have been for him. He should have said then and there that, yes, he was a thief, but never caught, and the worst that would have happened to him would have been to be sent out of Moscow. But Loschilin replied proudly, "I live by my own labor." And the interrogator directed no other charges at him, and the interrogation came to an end with that, and there was no trial. He was imprisoned in the cell for preliminary detention for 10 days, and then at night they took them all to the Moscow Criminal Investigation Department on Petrovka Street. Here things were crowded and stifling, and it was impossible to get through. The thieves were the rulers here. They took things away from the prisoners and lost them at cards. Here, for the first time, Loschilin was astonished by their strange boldness, their insistence on some kind of incomprehensible superiority. One night the authorities began to haul them all off to the transit prison on Sretenka. That was where it was before Krasnaya Preznya. and there it was even more crowded. People sat on the floor and took turns on the bunks. To those who were only half-clothed, left in their state by the thieves, the police issued clothing, bust, sandals, and old police uniforms. Among those sent there with Lost Chilin were many others who also had never been formally charged with anything, never called to court or tried, but they were transported just like those who had been sentenced. They took them to Perebori, where they filled out an invoice for those who had arrived, and it was only when he got there that Lost Chilin found his section, SBE, socially harmful element, sentenced 4 years. To this very day, he is in a state of dismay. After all, my father was a worker, and I myself am a worker, and why then was I an SBE? It would have been a different matter if I had been a trader. Volgolag, logging, a 10-hour work day and no days off except the November and May holidays, and this was 3 whole years before the war. And once Lost Chilin broke his leg and had an operation and spent 4 months in the hospital and 3 on crutches. And then he was again sent to logging, and so it was that he served out his 4-year term. The war began, but nonetheless he was not considered a 58, and in the autumn of 1941 he was released. Just before being released, Lost Chilin had his pea jacket stolen, but it was registered on his equipment card, and how he begged the trustees to write off that cursed pea jacket. But no, they refused to take pity on him. They took the cost of the pea jacket out of his release fund. Double the cost, in fact. And the government inventory prices for those torn cotton-padded treasures were very dear. And so, on a cold autumn day, they let him out of the camp gates, in a cotton camp shirt with scarcely any money, or any bread, or even a herring for the road. The gatehouse guard searched him at the exit and wished him good speed. And so he was plundered on the day of his release, just as he had been on the day of his arrest. When the documents were being written up in the office of the chief of the classification and records section, Lost Chilin managed to read upside down what was written in his file. What was written was, "Detained during tour of station." He arrived in the city of Sursk, his native area. Because he was ill, the district military conscription commissariat exempted him from military service. And that, too, turned out to be bad. In the autumn of 1942, under order number 336 of the People's Commissariat of Defense, the district military commissariat conscripted all men of call-up age who could perform physical labor. Lost Chilin landed in the labor detachment of the apartment maintenance section of the Ulyanovsk garrison. What kind of detachment this was and what the attitude toward it was can be judged from the fact that it contained many young men from the West Ukraine, whom they had managed to conscript before the war, but who had not been sent to the front because they were unreliable. And so Lost Chilin landed in another variety of the archipelago again, a militarized, unguarded camp, geared to accomplish the same kind of annihilation as other camps, through exhausting the inmates' last strength. A 10-hour workday, in the barracks, 2-story bunks without any bedding. When they went out to work, the barracks was deserted. They worked and went around in whatever of their own they had when they were taken from their homes and in their own underwear, without baths and without a change. They were paid a reduced wage, from which they were charged for bread, 21 ounces a day, and for their other food, which was bad and consisted of a first and second course served them twice a day. And they were even charged for the Chuvash bast sandals which they were issued. Among the detachment members, one was designated the commandant and another the chief of the detachment, but they had no rights. The whole show was bossed by M. Zheltov, the chief of the repair and construction office. He was like a prince who did exactly whatever he liked. When he gave orders, some of the detachment members were deprived of bread and lunch for 1 or 2 days at a time. "Where was there a law like that?" Lost Chilin asked. "Even in camp it wasn't like that." And at the same time, front-line soldiers recovering from wounds and still weak entered the detachment. There was a woman doctor attached to the detachment. She had the right to release prisoners from work because of illness, but Zheltov forbade her to. And being afraid of him, she wept, and she did not hide it from the detachment members. "That is freedom. That is our freedom for you," Everyone got infected with lice, and the bunks were swarming with bedbugs. But then this was no camp. They could complain. And they did complain. They wrote to the provincial newspaper and to the provincial party committee, and there was no answer from anywhere. The only response came from the municipal medical department, which carried out a thorough disinfection, gave everyone a good bath, and gave everyone a set of underwear and some bedding, all to be charged against their wages. In the winter of 1944 to 1945, at the beginning of the third year in the detachment, Los Chilean's own footwear became simply unusable, and he did not go to work. He was then and there tried for absenteeism and given 3 months of corrective labor work in that very same detachment, with a fine of 25% deducted from his wages. In the spring damp, Los Chilean could no longer walk about in bast sandals, and once again did not go to work. Once again he was sentenced, which, if one counts the other times he had been sentenced in absentia, made the fourth time in his life. This time he was sentenced in the so-called red corner of the barracks, and the verdict was 3 months of imprisonment. But they did not imprison him, because it was unprofitable for the state to undertake the maintenance of Los Chilean, because there was no form of imprisonment which could be worse than this labor detachment. This was in March 1945, and nothing worse would have happened had it not been for the fact that earlier he had written a complaint to the apartment maintenance section of the garrison, to the effect that Zheltov had promised to issue second-hand footwear to all of them, but did not do so. And the reason that he alone wrote such a complaint was that any collective complaint was strictly forbidden. For any such collective complaint, since it was contrary to the spirit of socialism, they could have given sentences under 58. So they summoned Los Chilean to the personnel section. "Turn in your work clothes." And the only thing that that mute slogger had ever gotten for his 3 years of labor, his work apron, Los Chilean took off and put quietly on the floor. And right there stood the precinct policeman who had been summoned by the apartment maintenance section. He took Los Chilean off to the police station and in the evening to the prison, but the duty officer at the prison found something not in order in his documents and refused to accept him. And the policeman then took Los Chilean back to the police station, and the road went past their detachment's barracks, and the policeman said, "Oh, go on, go there and rest. You aren't going to run off anywhere anyway. Wait for me one of these days." April 1945 came to an end. The legendary divisions had already rolled to the Elbe and surrounded Berlin. Every day the nation fired off salutes, flooding the heavens with red, green, and gold flares. On April 24th, Los Chilean was imprisoned in the Ulyanovsk provincial prison. Its cells were just as overcrowded as they had been in 1937. 17.5 ounces of bread, soup made from fodder turnips, or if from potatoes, from small potatoes, unpeeled and poorly washed. May the 9th, Victory Day, he spent in his cell. For several days they did not even know about the end of the war. Just as Los Chilean had greeted the war behind bars, that is how he also bade it farewell. After Victory Day, they sent off to a work colony the decree prisoners, in other words, absentees, those tardy at work, and sometimes also those who had been caught at petty thievery at work. What they did there was earth-moving work, construction, and unloading barges. They fed them badly. The camp was a new one. There was no doctor in it, and not even a nurse. Los Chilean got chilled and developed an inflammation of the sciatic nerve, and he was driven out to work anyway. He was on his last legs, and his legs had swelled up, and he was in a constant fever. They kept on, driving him out to work all the same. On July the 7th, 1945, the famous Stalinist amnesty struck, but Los Chilean did not have to last out until he was released under its terms, for on July the 24th, his own 3 month term came to an end, and they let him out then and there. "All the same," says Los Chilean, "in my soul I am a Bolshevik. When I die, consider me a communist." Maybe he's joking, but then again, maybe he's not. I do not have here the material to complete this chapter the way I would like, to demonstrate the striking intersection of Russian lives and the laws of the archipelago, and I have no hope that I will be granted another secure and unhurried period in which to carry out one more editing of this book, and at that time to include the missing life stories. I think it would be very appropriate here to include a sketch on the life, prison, and camp persecutions and death of Father Pavel A. Florensky, perhaps one of the most remarkable men devoured by the archipelago of all time. Well-informed people say of him that he was a scholar rare for the 20th century, who had attained a professional mastery of a multitude of knowledge. He was educated as a mathematician, and in his youth he had experienced a deep religious conversion and become a priest. The book he had written in his youth, The Pillar and the Affirmation of the Truth, is only today coming into its own. He had to his credit many essays in mathematics, topological theorems proved much later in the West, in art history, on Russian icons, on religious drama, and on philosophical and religious subjects. His archive has been in the main preserved and has not yet been published. I have not had access to it. After the revolution, he was a professor at the Electrical Engineering Institute, where he delivered his lectures in his priest's robes. In 1927, he expressed ideas anticipating those of Wiener. In 1932, he published in the magazine Socialist Reconstruction and Science an essay on machines for the solution of problems which were close in spirit to cybernetics. Soon after that, he was arrested. His prison career is known to me only at several separate points, which I list with trepidation. Exile in Siberia. In exile, he wrote works and published them under a pseudonym in the works of the Siberian expedition of the Academy of Sciences. Solovki, and after Solovki was shut down, the Far North, and according to some sources, the Kolyma. In the Kolyma, he studied flora and minerals, in addition to his work with a pick. Neither the place nor the date of his death in camp is known, but according to some rumors, he was shot during wartime. I certainly intended to cite here also the life of Valentin I. Komov from the Yefremov district, with whom I was imprisoned in the years 1950 to 1952 in Ekibastutz, but I simply do not recall enough about him, and I ought to have remembered more details. In 1929, when he was a 17-year-old boy, he killed the chairman of the local village Soviet and fled. After that, the only way he could exist and hide was as a thief. He was imprisoned several times, always as a thief. In 1941, he was released. The Germans carried him off to Germany. Did he collaborate with them? No, he ran away twice, and as a result landed in Buchenwald. He was liberated from there by the Allies. Did he stay in the West? No. Under his authentic family name, the motherland has forgiven, the motherland calls you. He returned to his own village, where he married and worked in the collective farm. In 1946, he was imprisoned under 58 for his 1929 crime. He was released in 1955. If this biography were set forth in detail, it would explain much to us about the Russian lives of those decades. In addition, Komov was a typical camp brigadier, a son of Gulag, and even in the hard labor camp he was not afraid to shout at the chief at the general roll call, "Why do we have a fascist system in our camp?" Finally, it would have been appropriate to include in this chapter the biography of some socialist who was exceptional in personal qualities, in the steadfastness of his views, in order to show his peregrinations through the moves of the big solitaire over a period of many years. And perhaps the biography of some inveterate MVD man, a Garanin, or a Zavanyagin, or else someone not so well known, would have been highly suitable here. But evidently, I am not fated to do all that. Breaking off this book at the beginning of 1967, I do not count on having a chance to return to the theme of the archipelago. No, completing it a year later. Anyway, it's enough. I have been with it 20 years. End of part 4.
This concludes the reading of Volume 2 of the Gulag Archipelago. This book was read by Frederick Davidson. If you would like to receive a free catalogue listing our complete line of audiobooks, write us at Post Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call toll-free 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate, so as to present the book in order for the next person to enjoy? Thank you.